Good evening and welcome to City Visions, celebrating our 20th year on KALW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, our topic is design, disability, and social justice, Berkeley's Ed Roberts campus. We've all heard of green design, the widely embraced architectural movement based on the core value of environmental sustainability. But what about design focused on social sustainability? This hour, we're going to explore a parallel movement known as universal design. Universal design holds that architecture and other forms of design should be usable by the widest range of people operating in the widest range of situations. For example, from young to old, or those who are abled and those who are disabled. As it happens, the Bay Area is now home to a national model of universal design. It's the newly completed 85,000 square foot campus, that's named after Ed Roberts, that's housed in Berkeley, which also happens to be the birthplace of the disability rights movement in this country. 15 years in the making, the campus was designed by and for a consortium of disability rights groups, and it aims to become the foremost center for disability rights, advocacy, and education in the world. But how exactly does one design a building that accounts for the innumerable variations in human ability? Can universally accessible buildings be beautiful as well? What role does design play in the broader disability rights movement? And what role can the Ed Roberts campus play in bringing about wider acceptance of universal design among architects nationwide? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these questions and more are Dimitri Belser. He's executive director for the Center for Accessible Technology, which works to provide access to computers for people with disabilities. And he is also president of the Ed Roberts campus. Welcome, Dimitri.
Welcome.
And we're also joined by Susan Henderson. She is executive director of Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, a national disability rights law and policy center that advances the civil and human rights of people with disabilities. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, we're joined by Bill Letty. He's a founding partner of Letty, Matem, Stacey Architects, a San Francisco-based firm focused on sustainable and socially conscious design. And he and others designed and executed the plans for the Ed Roberts campus. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks very much for having me.
And as always, we welcome you, our listeners, to join in our conversation tonight. We'll open the phones in a little less than 20 minutes, and you can call us at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can start emailing us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And just a note to people who might be emailing us, you might get a bounce back email that your email did not get through. Rest assured, your emails will get through. But if you're really worried about it, you should just call us. 415-841-4134. Again, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Dimitri Belser, I wanted to start with you. Tell us a little bit about Ed Roberts and how his life inspired this campus.
Well, Ed Roberts was one of the first, he was one of the leaders of the disability rights movement. He was one of the first people with a serious disability to attend the University of California at Berkeley. When he went to Cal, they were very confused as to what to do with him, and they housed him at Cowell Hospital because they didn't have accessible dorms. And he and a group of other people who were wheelchair users started getting together and thinking about how their lives really, they really needed to have more control over their lives, that they needed to stop letting other people run their lives and instead really living independently. And so they came up with this concept of the of independent living. And out of that group came those people at Cal came a group of people who started the Center for Independent Living in Berkeley. And Ed was definitely one of those people there. Ed went on in his life and had a lot of success and did a lot of things, helped start independent living centers throughout the world. A lot of the agencies at the Ed Roberts campus came out of the independent living centers, the Center for Independent Living. So there was a lot of a lot germinated from the work that they did. And one of the stories that I always think about with Ed is that when Ed went to the University of California, students with disabilities had to get the Department of Rehabilitation to pay for their services. And Department of Rehabilitation is based on employability, and they refused to pay for Ed's services because they said he was unemployable. And then later in his life, he became the director of the California Department of Rehabilitation. So living well really is the best revenge.
When Ed was advocating for the changes that he was and talking about independent living, what types of barriers were people with disabilities fighting against, besides the ones you've already mentioned, that where this concept of independent living was considered something sort of phenomenally new?
Well, you know, it really was something phenomenally new, and it was really about, up until that time, I think that all services for people with disabilities were really based on a medical model and really about, and really came out of pity. And that it was a really new concept for people to develop some pride in being a person with a disability and to have some control over your life. And it was actually very counterintuitive to a lot of people. People would say, well, you know, you can't dress yourself, you can't bathe yourself, how can you live independently? And the concept was, well, that may be true for some of us, that we can't dress ourselves or bathe ourselves or use the bathroom or drive, but we can control how that stuff happens. If you need assistance, you control the assistant rather than being a passive person in this and just having these things happen to you.
And it's not an all or nothing thing.
Exactly. And that, in fact, very few people in the world can make everything happen for them. You know, very few people grow their own food, for example. And no one thinks of themselves as being less independent because you have to buy the food that's in the supermarket. It's, you know, it's just something that you do as part of your life. You control what food you buy, even though you're not creating it. It's the same thing with the independent living movement, that people really will control their lives, in even if they need assistance in various things.
And Susan Henderson, welcome to the program. I wanted to bring you in here because it was the two of you whose organizations are now housed in the Ed Roberts campus who had a lot to do with how this campus was developed in the first place. And I wanted to see if you could tell me the history of sort of how the concept for this campus came to be.
So as to me, when Ed Roberts died in 1995, the city of Berkeley came to the disability community and said, we'd like to memorialize Ed's life in some manner. What do you think? And it basically started out as a park bench, you know, let's put his name on a park bench. And, you know, that didn't seem like enough. And then, you know, it was a street, you know, so all these concepts went through. And I think the group looked around and said, you know what, we have this independent living movement that grew out of Berkeley. We realized we'd come out of the Center for Independent Living. And it was like, it was time to, you know, bring us back together. And we just recognized that there was something bigger, you know, there was something bigger that needed Ed's name on it. And we wanted all to benefit and the community to benefit from it at the same time. So the concept of a building came out.
We wanted to also have a place where the movement actually had visibility. At that point, all of us were in, or most of us were in, rented buildings. You know, the building where the Center for Accessible Technology was, excuse me, we didn't have our name on the outside of the building. No one knew we were there if they weren't looking for us. And being in a place that really gave the movement some real visibility in the community was very important to us.
Because extending from your earlier comments, it sounds like what was important to kind of set the message is that not only can people live independently, but people should be able to work and be part of the workforce and have work to do and should have places that perhaps adapt or are adaptable to their needs. So what you're saying there is by having it be clear and out there that you're advancing or expanding the scope of what people imagine is possible.
That's exactly right. And you know, so we started dreaming about having this building and what it would look like. And we didn't know what it would look like. But we knew that we wanted to have a building that really helped further our missions, that helped really tell the story of who we were. And we found an architect who started talking to us about how architecture really does shape the lives of the people who are within the building and shape the mission of the organizations. And so we realized with his guidance that we could create a building that would really be something that helped further what we do and also help tell our story.
And what kinds of things were you looking to accomplish besides a visibility in designing this building or co-designing this building that would help to address some of the concerns that perhaps had not been addressed or had only partially been addressed by the disability rights movement or legislation or the independent living concept up until then?
Well, we all knew there are certain things about the disability community that are kind of universal. Many of us depend on public transit to get to work, to get to, you know, school, to get wherever. So one of the things that we wanted to show was that we wanted to be near public transit. So that narrowed down where we were going to locate. We knew that we wanted to show that we had a presence in the community, whereas we were all sort of, even though we were included in the community in a sense, we were distributed in small pockets in tiny buildings. And we, like Dimitri said, we wanted to be visible. We wanted to see, not only have the people without disabilities see people with disabilities working, we also wanted to provide a peer group for younger people with disabilities so they saw people with disabilities working. I just read an article about a young woman who did an internship at New Mobility magazine last summer. She had with spina bifida. She had never identified as a person with a disability. She never knew that she could be working on furthering the lives of other people with disabilities. And I thought that was kind of incredible. Mm-hmm. She'd never even heard about the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think when you bring, you know, we're, you know, pushing out our mission-driven, you know, organizations, pushing our message out, and we're only stronger together, so.
And then when you're thinking of the design elements of the building, which we're going to get to in just a moment with our architect here, Bill Letty, but what kinds of things were important to you, Dimitri, in trying to say, you know, this is what we need to be considering and this is how we should be considering it?
Well, for me, you know, my organization was in a building that was a converted warehouse, and most of the organizations were in similar buildings. So first of all, we didn't want it to be a dump. but we really wanted to change the way that people think about disability services. And we realized pretty early on that architecture was going to be a big part of that, that having a building that didn't look like an institution. You know, most buildings that are rehab hospitals, they look very institutional. They look like junior high schools. And the worst kind of junior high schools, that would be. And having a building that really changed that whole paradigm and really became a building that was very open, that had lots of glass, had lots of natural light, that was not what you thought about for disability services. You kind of thought about dark and private and hidden. And as soon as you get to hidden, you get to shameful. And we wanted to change that. We wanted to say, we wanted to welcome the community into our lives. And we wanted a building that helped us do that.
So it sounds like as important as symbolism was, of course, functionality was as important, if not more important. I don't know, perhaps they're
well,
equally important.
Well, I mean, they're both important.
I think one of the things that the way, you know, if you've seen images of the building, you notice there's this signature ramp in the building. And one of the things that we talked about a lot in our meetings was that people who use wheelchairs are off, if there's an emergency or fire or something and they're not on the ground floor and the elevator's shut down, you're stuck until somebody comes and rescues you. And nobody wanted to be in that situation. So you can imagine what Loma Prieta was like for all of these organizations who were on multi-story buildings. So that was one of the things that we really knew was important, that we always wanted to have egress. So that was one of the design, something that became a design feature.
Okay, I want to bring Bill Letty into the conversation now. He's the founding partner of Letty, Batem, Stacey Architects, San Francisco-based firm that actually designed and executed the plans for the Ed Roberts campus that we sort of talked around but not actually talked about very much in detail yet. And so in your comments, Bill, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what universal design is, because we haven't defined it yet. And perhaps in sort of taking us through like a walkthrough of
sure.
the building, you can sort of maybe give us examples of the design elements that speak to the principles of universal design.
Sure. So I want to circle back a little bit to a phrase that you used at the beginning of the show that maybe a lot of folks haven't heard before, which is social sustainability. Mm. We've heard a lot about environmental sustainability. I think there's an emerging awareness that we need to think more broadly about the word of sustaining our society in the future generations, and we think more and more now as architects in particular about creating a future, helping our fellow citizens imagine a future that is really all about social justice and environmental justice. Those things, elements together, create this kind of powerful vision for the future, we think. And so universal design is an element, is a part of that, that helps to create environments, as you said, that, that really welcome everybody regardless of their abilities. And I think that's key. It's different from, you know, what was known as barrier-free design, or what the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, might require by code, in the sense that it goes beyond the minimum requirements and addresses the broadest possible range of people's needs and requirements, and does it with a I would say with an amount of grace. I think one of the things that you do when you just design to the minimum requirement is that you eliminate the notion that everyone deserves to have a dignified place to go to work and a place where they can feel inspired. Fundamentally for us, universal design and really good design in general is really a social justice issue. It's all about creating environments that for everyone that give them a sense of grace and a daily inspiration of being able to go to work. So
like equity to access and equity of ability to experience a building.
Absolutely. And so when we started designing the building with Dimitri and Susan and the rest of the board of the ERC, the Ed Roberts campus, we first talked about the building having a strong civic presence, as Dimitri has alluded to, that it needs to kind of have this sense that this is an important place for these folks to be in this community. And so when you arrive at the building, there's a broad semicircular plaza that is a welcoming element, but it's also a kind of environment that allows someone with a cane who is blind arriving at this building for the first time to find their way very easily to the front door. So as you move through the building, there's a whole series of strategies that help that attempt to multiply the benefit. You walk in the front door. There's a big volume, and as Susan mentioned, a dramatic helical ramp, 60 feet in diameter, that coils up through the space, bright red glowing resin made from recycled milk cartons, and the idea was that you can't just address the needs, the practical needs of people in general. You have to do it with some poetry and some character. And so what this does is the front of the building is to provide both a practical element of access for everyone, inviting even people who are ambulatory to access the second floor that way. But also, it becomes maybe a more powerful symbol of universal design right at the front of the building and present to everyone as they walk in. And then as you go through, you find other layers upon layers of strategies. For example, acoustical environments that are designed for people with hearing disabilities to make sure that the noises are such that they can discern them more easily in a crowded building.
What did you employ for that?
Soft surfaces on the ceiling. You know, in this case, the floor had to be pretty hard and durable because of the number of people using wheelchairs, and that's easy for them to move around. But that creates a very reverberant acoustical environment. So we had to provide some spaces that were some surfaces that were absorptive. One of my favorites is a small a fountain that's in the central atrium space. Well, we've all seen fountains in atrium spaces. That's not such an unusual thing. The nice thing about this one is that it actually provides a landmark, if you will, for people who have sight disabilities, so they can orient themselves in the space with the sound of the fountain. It also happens to be a nice place to have a sandwich next to. But it's finding those elements. Universal design isn't about finding things that are applied or are shouting out that they are for special needs. It's about gracefully weaving these elements within a cohesive environment that works for everybody.
Hmm. And staying with this for a moment, tell us some more about some of the other materials that you used or other design elements that you, with the input of the organizations that are inhabiting the building, that you came up with that perhaps were new to you that you had never thought of before, or challenges that you had to solve before.
I think that one of the really, I think, lovely stories about this building that I've really enjoyed telling is that we have a wayfinding devices that are cast into the concrete. So essentially, it's very simple. There's just two different colors of concrete, a lighter color and a darker color, that define the pathway. But we also wanted to provide a texture, a different texture, so that people with canes can actually discern the texture. And so when it came time to actually, you know, get the right texture on the concrete, we invited an architect named Chris Downey, who's actually a blind architect, to come to the site with his canes. And he and I stood there while the sandblaster would sandblast the concrete, and then he would walk in and try it out, and then he'd say, no, I think a little more. And so we'd step back, and he'd sandblast a little more. And I think it's that kind of both kind of direct experience that applied to the building that I think, at one hand, kind of makes it more personal and makes it more actual effective. But I think it also, in the end, kind of tells you that it really gives you a sense of the whole range of experience that people have of the built environment, and it gives you a much broader perception of what's really possible.
And my understanding is that this was, in moving beyond ADA minimum requirements, we're also expanding the notion of what kinds of abilities or disabilities needed to be addressed, so beyond just, for example, mobility, which I think ADA is sort of very keen on, is mobility issues, but sounds like vision and hearing, and also environmental concerns.
Chemical
as well.
Sensitivity. There's a big overlap between traditional sustainable design strategies, which have to do with creating healthy indoor environments that are as free as possible of any sort of toxic materials. And, of course, there are many people who are very sensitive, hypersensitive to these issues. And so I think the idea of kind of creating environments that are as absolutely clean as possible is another feature of the building.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about universal design with our guest Dimitri Belser. He's executive director of the Center for Accessible Technology, which works to provide access to computers for people with disabilities, and he's also president of the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley that we're discussing tonight. We're also joined by Susan Henderson, executive director of the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, a national Disability Rights Law and Policy Center that advances the civil and human rights of people with disabilities, and Bill Letty, founding partner of Letty, Madam, Stacey Architects, a San Francisco-based firm focused on sustainable and socially conscious design. And they were the design and executive architects for the Ed Roberts campus. And we invite you, our listeners, to join us now with your questions and comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And as I said at the top of the hour, even if you get a bounce back message, the emails are coming through. feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or 415-841-4134. If you are someone with a disability and want to talk about what your challenges navigating the world and spaces within it are, and how this kind of campus speaks to you, and the kinds of places that you would like to see more of, please call us, 415-841-4134, or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And if you are a person who was just curious about universal design and wants to know more about it and has some thoughts about what other things we might want to do in application of the concepts of universal design, or some questions or concerns about the concept, 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So Susan and Dimitri, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation now that Bill has given us a visual walkthrough to describe your experience of using the building as employees of the organizations that are housed there. And why don't we start with you, Dimitri?
Okay. You know, it's an incredible place. It's an amazing place for me to work. I am a person who, I'm a person who's blind. I'm low vision. And so I use a cane to get around. And the building is so is so beautiful and so accessible and so just welcoming. You know, one of the first experiences I had in the building was when we were designing the building. Bill would often talk about how as he mentioned earlier, the plaza in front of the building is a civic gesture. It was a gesture of the city to welcome people into the building. And I always thought, oh, that's, you know, sort of an interesting description. And once we moved into the building, we had so many people who would come up and just say, this building seems to draw me in. I feel drawn to it. It feels like such an exciting and welcoming place. But it's an amazing place to be. Just being in a place with all the other agencies and being in a place that's so beautifully designed is really an incredible experience for us.
And what about some of the practical or structural features that are really changing your work, day-to-day work experience?
Well, for me, it's been a lot of things. It's really a huge thing for our clients, being located at the BART station. We were nowhere near a BART station in our old offices. People being able to get to the second floor where our offices are without having to use an elevator is a huge piece of it. Just the light in the building, for me, is really important. My old offices did not have very good light, and it was very difficult for me use a computer or to, you know, be in the space. And so this building is just much more... It's just amazing all of the layers that we went through. And you know, you mentioned at the beginning that we spent 15 years designing this. Those 15 years were well spent, because we spent a lot of time going through this whole process of really thinking about all the ways that different people with different disabilities worked. And in fact, we came up with a concept that we used to refer to as dueling disabilities, where because some people with disabilities have differing needs, and I can describe that really easily. People who are wheelchair users do not like curbs. They would like the street and the sidewalk to be level, because it would be easy to get into it. But for blind people like me, we love curbs, because curbs tell us you're not on the street. And so how do you weigh those two interests? What do you do about that? In designing the plaza, blind people like right angles and really well-defined paths of travel, and wheelchair users like to be able to cut across. So there was a lot of talk about how do we accommodate all of that. And That was a lot of the process of designing the building.
So would you say that in getting involved in this project with other organizations and other people who had different needs, that perhaps it was brokering conversations that hadn't been had before or had not been had at this level before?
Oh, certainly. We had those dueling disability conversations about, you know, rough surfaces, you know, slick surfaces, thick carpet, flat, you know, no thresholds. Just the way the doors open, or who wants their door locked and who wants it to open automatically, who wants it to open with a paddle. I mean, and then actually getting that to work were things we spent hours and hours discussing. And you do learn about different people's unique needs and or even, you know, desires, I guess. It's been fascinating. One of the things that I realized about the building just the other day was that we all came from, most of us came from converted warehouses. And I don't know if this happens in other nonprofits, but we had a big open area, a big open workspace, and we talked across that workspace all the time. It's part of our culture that we would, you know, look over the workstation wall and yell to somebody at the Ed Roberts campus. It's kind of the same, except for, you know, in our own workspaces. But when you go out into the common area, you can see from one walkway to the other walkway across the building and say hello to somebody, or say, oh, that reminds me, I needed to talk to you. As you leave the building or come in, you can say hello to the people on the first floor when you're walking across the second floor. So it's very, I don't know if you planned it, Bill, but it's very community building in a way that I hadn't thought about. Except for running into people in the hallways, it's more than that. You run into people in the building.
And it was such an exciting process, because we were designing this, and as the community came together to talk about this, we discovered that we had all of this knowledge that together we could share, and we all had these moments where people would say something and we'd go, wow, I never thought of that. And we'd start bouncing those ideas off each other. And now that we're in the building and we're all in one place, that synergy just keeps growing, and there's more and more of that happening. It's a very exciting place to work.
Any other things you would add, Susan, about your experience working in this space that are many times different than your experiences
in other
workspaces?
Buildings.
Yeah.
Sure. I feel like I have, as a person who has a mobility impairment, but I don't use a wheelchair. But there are times when one day it's easier for me to walk than another. Now I have options. I can go up the ramp, I can take an elevator, or I can take the stairs. And it's my choice. You know, it's like I don't have to worry. I don't only get to take the elevator. It's interesting to watch people's paths. Other people with the same kinds of issues choose the ramp versus the elevator, or choose the stairs. There's a group in the office in the building that do a circuit for exercise, mm-hmm. using all three of those things. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, I mean, I have choices. I think all of my wheelchair using coworkers have options, which they don't typically have.
And again, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking universal design with our guest Dimitri Belser, Executive Director of the Center for Accessible Technology and President of the Ed Roberts Campus, Susan Henderson, Executive Director of the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, and Bill Letty, Founding Partner of Letty Maiton Stacy Architects, who designed the Ed Roberts campus. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to call in with questions or comments by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And actually, let's go to an email. This email comes from Sophie, and she says, I live three blocks from the building, but never was asked for input. Why isn't the definition of community, put in quotes, include physical proximity? P.S. The new arrangement for parking cars requires many to walk through a tunnel to get to the station from the east lot, which is a frightening experience for a woman alone. Why not take us into account when implementing a design? So perhaps we'll start with you, Bill,
Sure. Well, this is an interesting question, because we went through a period of community outreach with the Ed Roberts campus. Actually, this started before we even got involved. Mm-hmm. So it was one that went on for several years, meeting with individual neighbors, with neighborhood groups, a whole variety of community public meetings. And so I regret that this particular individual didn't attend any of those meetings, apparently, because the design was one that was very carefully discussed with the Berkeley Design Review Committee, and also with the Berkeley Landmarks Advisory Committee, and then the Planning Department as well. So, Dimitri, you want to?
Well, and in fact, we did a lot of work. We did an incredible amount of work with the community. We went out and reached out into the community. We went and did kitchen chats, and we had neighborhood focus groups, and we did a lot of outreach. I'm sorry this person wasn't part of that, but most of the people in that neighborhood, I think, were. We walked the neighborhoods a lot. I went to almost all of the houses in the Ed Roberts campus neighborhood, and so we went to a lot of people's places and really tried to get people involved and wanted to know, and we also listened to them. You know, the original design for the building was going to be a three-story building, and the neighbors told us very clearly that was too big for their neighborhood, and we reduced the size of the building based on their input. We changed the way the parking works, the entrance, the BART parking lot, based on neighborhood input. So there was a lot of collaboration in this.
Actually, that reminds me of another sort of illustration that I wanted to make that I think is a really powerful one of the that happened during the community review process. There are many folks in the community who were concerned about the impact of this building on the potential historic fabric of the area. There was no real designation for the area, but you know, people were still concerned. And so we went to the Berkeley Landmarks Board, and to review the building. And at one point, finally, towards the end of the evening, a gentleman who was there, severely disabled in a reclining wheelchair, rolled up to the front of the Landmarks Board and said, "I'm your worst nightmare, because someday you might end up like me." And he said, "But I want you to know that I've been going in the back doors of buildings my entire life, and I'll be so proud to go in the front door of this one." And that's when I realized, I think, even more powerfully than ever, that this is really about the entire community. It's not about one or two people. It's about embracing the entire community in the broadest possible way. And I think in the end, we hope we did provide a place that provides people with this sense of grace and dignity as they walk in.
And to follow up on the second part of Sophie's question here, which is talking about how the parking lot, I guess, was reconfigured to include now a a tunnel that people had to walk through, and how that feels frightening to her for as a woman. And it, I guess, brings up the question of, you know, no matter how much we implement, there's multiple other needs that perhaps you can never fully implement, or and there is a limit, so that universal isn't universal ultimately.
We can get close.
And I guess how did you decide, and what other situations did you come across where you had to say, you know what, that's a great idea, but for whatever sets of reasons, costs or time, that you had to say, you know, that's great, but not here, not now?
Well, I think first of all, there's no tunnel. There's a large open trellis element that frames the entrance to the BART parking lot. But I'm not a little unclear on what the reference to the dark tunnel is, because I'm not aware of one. But
she says through a tunnel to get to the station from the east lot, just to make sure.
Oh, I see. So that's the concourse underneath, I think. But the answer to the question is that there were several points along the way where we, you know, one of the things we wanted to do for the building was to make it replicable. We wanted to encourage it to be repeated as many, not specifically that building, but the concepts of universal design. So we made a very conscious choice early on in the process with everybody at the table to use simple technologies. And so, for example, we say, well, you know, there's all this great technology that has to do with infrared signs, you know, talking signs and so forth. That technology is evolving still. And so we said, well, you know, we could add that later, but now is not the time. So we can do this with some more simple technologies and more simple strategies.
Susan, you want to add something?
I just want to say that I'm pretty sure Sophie's referring to the causeway that takes you up the stairs, the new entrance out of the East Park, out of the station up to Adeline, whereas you used to go right out into the parking lot. But, Sophie, you should know there's another option. You can take the elevator out of the station up to Adeline Street instead of walking through the tunnel at night. So there's an option for you.
Okay. And I wanted to stay with this notion of sort of what are the limits of universal design by also getting at how was this, what kinds of other resistance perhaps or other issues did you as a group and as an architect have to come up against? We mentioned one around the historic preservation. We talked about how neighbors gave input about the height of the building. What other things did you come up against in trying to get this approved and funded, et cetera? Dimitri?
Well, I mean, the whole process of going through approvals took quite a lot of time, and there was, you know, there were definitely some people who were opposed to having the project built for a variety of reasons.
And what were those reasons?
You know, some people whose houses overlooked the BART lot were afraid that it would spoil their views or spoil the look of the lot, or you know, block light, or I actually don't remember all of the reasons that people had. There was a lot of the neighbors became very excited about the building because they realized that the Ashby BART parking lot was one of the most dangerous ones in the system before the Ed Roberts campus was built. It wasn't necessarily violent crime, although that certainly happened, but there were a lot of places in the East parking lot before that were very hidden, and so people could be selling drugs and having sex and doing all kinds of things down there that they, you know, you didn't really want happening in your neighborhood. And so having the Ed Roberts campus there has really brought a lot more light and visibility to those spaces and solved a lot of those problems, and that the fact that there's a lot of people there has really been a big improvement to the community.
Mm. And
I think one of the things that was an interesting thing to get through was just the economic model of the project, because I think the many folks would look at this and think of it as an office building. Well, for an office building, it's got an awful lot of common space. So in point of fact, it's really a building that is a mixed-use building. It has offices. It has large conference centers and community gathering spaces. It has a child care center for kids with and without disabilities. It has a small fitness center, a cafe. I mean, it's a mixed-use project that doesn't really fit within the typical kind of development model. So I think that was another kind of frame of mind rejiggering that needed to take place as we were designing the project.
And how was the project funded?
It was funded through a variety of public funding, primarily from the federal government because of the location at a transit hub. So it was one of those things we realized right away. We had this great need to be near transportation, and the federal government had this great need to infill transit and build transit hubs, though we didn't fit the model for that because usually they want housing, and we weren't doing housing. So we had some, you know, we had to work around that. Private fundraising, so from foundations and individuals, and also, what was the third
traditional
thing?
Traditional loans.
Mm-hmm. And we also just to close the deal, to finish the deal, we got all of our funding for the core building in August 2008. So you could imagine if it was September 2008, we probably wouldn't be sitting in our new offices. But then we needed to raise additional funds to do the tenant improvements, and we did that through the new market tax credit financing, which is another whole show.
So did you notice that because your concept was a relatively new one and because it didn't fit traditional funding models, that you had to do a lot of translating, or did you have to cut out things in order to make it fit a funder's requirements, or did people come meet you partway and say, okay, we're willing to kind of modify our requirements because of this project? Dimitri's saying no.
It was a stretch. And part of the problem was that a lot of people thought, I think a lot of foundations looked at it and said, these small disability nonprofits want to build this very expensive project. They want to do it in Berkeley, kind of known for difficulty in the building process, on top of BART. And I think there was a lot of, well, good luck with that kind of attitude we got from people. And it was hard to get foundations in particular to step up. And it was really when we finally got the first foundation to say, okay, we believe you're going to do this and we're going to give you money. That was a pretty huge moment for us. It was, you know, that process took a long time. And the concept of what we're doing was very hard to explain. It took us a while to really be able to tell our story well. And, you know, and get people to really understand what it was we were doing.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking universal design with our guest Dimitri Belser, Executive Director of the Center for Accessible Technology and President of the Ed Roberts Campus, Susan Henderson, Executive Director of the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, and Bill Letty, Founding Partner of Letty, Mayton, Stacey Architects. Again, 415-841-4134, the number to dial to join our conversation this evening. That's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So moving to you, Bill, so this concept not particularly accessible, so to speak, to the minds of funders. How about to the minds of architects, your colleagues? Was this a stretch? What do architects think in general? Now, of course, you don't represent architects in general, but how does the architecture world interface with the concept of universal design?
You know, I think it's an emerging awareness. There are many folks who've been practicing universal design and exploring deep research in this area for many, many years, but I think it's had a difficult time kind of achieving any broader level of acceptance in my profession, yeah, for a number of reasons. I think partly because many architects have viewed the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act to be difficult to deal with and sometimes unreasonable. And the whole notion of kind of going beyond that and providing spaces that are even more welcoming to people with disabilities, it might seem to be a little bit disconcerting. But I could say
so maybe saying that the architects think of ADA requirements as barriers to good design as opposed to ways to
yes and no. I think some might, but I think that the good news is that there's a blossoming awareness of this issue and of the broader issue of social sustainability in the profession, to the point where in October I was with a fact gathering group of the American Institute of Architects who went to Japan, where where these issues, universal design, is much more broadly practiced, to do collect some data and some information, find out what best practices are there. And now that information is being applied to the May convention with the American Institute of Architects, where we're going to be presenting some of our findings and to talk about universal design in a broader sense. So I think the conversation is just beginning. We say that, you know, universal design today is kind of where sustainable design was 20 years ago or 10 years ago. I think the big challenge is to kind of get beyond all of these adjectives before the word design and just think of it all as good design, and that good design embraces the environment, it embraces social justice, it embraces all of these issues seamlessly.
And why would places like, maybe not surprisingly, but maybe surprisingly, like Asia and Europe perhaps be ahead of the curve on this and not the U.S.?
Well, Japan in particular is ahead because the portion of the population that is aged is so much larger than it is in the United States. And so many of the companies there that are providing these products for building products and so forth for people with various disabilities are really focusing on senior housing and the needs of the aging community. But I think it's also of course a much bigger issue than that, and I think that's important. We're all going to become old and need help, but I think eventually the idea here is to broaden it out so that it becomes a situation where every building is welcoming to everyone, regardless of their age or their abilities or their personal circumstances.
In fact, we were talking just before the program about this concept of why would this concept of universal design appeal to a broader audience, perhaps besides those that have ability challenges. And I believe it was, Dimitri, you had a sort of a really great way of making that
well, I think stick in my head. I don't think it stuck, but what I was saying was
I'm setting it up for you.
Okay. what I was saying was that, you know, the disability community is really the one minority group that everybody gets to join, that it's very unlikely if you were not born African American that you'll become African American, but if you do not have a disability now, at some point in your life you most likely will. Maybe a temporary disability, maybe a permanent disability, but it is the community that everyone gets to sooner or later.
Mm. And this concept of temporarily abled was another term. Susan, did you want to describe that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I could just use my own experience. You know, I was, I'm disabled because of a car accident, so I'm an amputee, but I use a prosthesis, so I walk. Last year, I slipped and fell and broke the leg that I wear my prosthetic on, so I couldn't wear my prosthesis. So I used a wheelchair for 4 months, and then crutches and a cane. And that, even just that sort of spectrum of more impaired mobility taught me a lot about the environment. Using a wheelchair actually out in the world was a real eye-opener for me. And I think that a lot of people, you know, it only takes a second, you know, for somebody to go from being what they perceive as able to do anything to not be able to do anything without assistance. Mm-hmm. And not think of that as, you know, we talk a lot about independent living and understanding disability, that it's not, you know, it's life-changing, but it's not necessarily life-ending.
Mm-hmm. Or I think we were also talking about something, you know, someone who has a lot of packages in their hands and it's a really rainy day and how do you navigate the doors and the umbrella and the packages, and that, in fact, you could see any one person.
We can use our elbows now.
Right. Despite their sort of baseline level of ability, there are certain circumstances or situations that could turn that on a dime, whether it's something that rises to the level of disability that you've been describing or versus something that sort of is just one of those situations that sort of comes and goes but can be seen as something from as little as an inconvenience to something that's a major hindrance in moving around in the world. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go to one of our callers, 415-841-4134, if you'd like to join us, but let's go to Penny from Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Great, great, great program. I've really learned a lot. I use a wheelchair, and I've been to the Ed Roberts campus several times. And you really do have to go to appreciate the sense of spatial, the sense of openness and there were some accessibility features that I didn't know were accessibility features until just now. But I want to talk about universal design a little bit. 25 years ago, the apartment building I'm living in was built, and it was to be for seniors and 10% of the population for people with disabilities. And they asked the disabled community for advice, and the community said, universal design. You're dealing with seniors. You're going to be aging. If somebody breaks a hip, they have to go to a nursing home if they can't use a wheelchair in their unit. And they said the building people decided to ignore that advice. And sure enough, I've seen a lot of people in those over the years get carted off because they are no longer able to function independently in their apartment due to the design of the apartment. And I guess what I'd like to see is to have all buildings have that sense of possibility that I kind of have gotten just going into the Ed Roberts campus and seeing the feeling the light, seeing the spaciousness, seeing all the different features and thinking, gee, you could do a lot here.
Well, thank you so much, Penny, for your call.
Yeah, thanks.
So I think what Penny's getting at there is this idea that it sounds like what ADA has made people do is you know, come in on the ground floor and say, these are the minimum ways you have to allow a building to have adaptability to different types of ability or needs. And my sense from our conversation tonight is that we're moving towards this idea of a more fluid and flexible environment that can continuously adapt over time to evolving needs. And I'm curious, Bill, how did you account for that in your design of this building?
Well, I think once again, I think the approach is to find the simple solution. So, for example, the ramp and the corridors are 7 feet wide rather than the traditional 5 or 4 feet wide, and because you want to make sure that there's enough room for, say, two people in wheelchairs to pass without having to back up and find a different place to turn around. And in fact, even better than that, two people could pass in a wheelchair, and one person ambulatory could be between them having a conversation. So I think, you know, providing enough space, and I think this is really fundamentally the major sort of cost addition that might be implied with universal design, is providing enough space so there's enough room to really move around the building graciously. And that, I think, when you provide those kinds of basic bones, great enough circulation space, simple circulation patterns, so people, for example, with cognitive disabilities can you know, if they miss it the first time around, they can catch it the second time around without being embarrassed.
This is this concept called tolerance for error.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. Good.
Uh-huh.
Good.
Yeah.
Did your homework. and I think the idea of as I mentioned earlier, of finding simple ways to kind of get in the building and make that very clear. If you approach the building from those basic points of view, then there's plenty of room as technologies evolve and as needs change to make minor adjustments as time goes on. And I think that's the basic approach.
And is housing the next frontier here, Susan and Dimitri?
I think housing may even be ahead of us in some places.
Hmm.
So because it's such a personal issue with families, you know, people, it's a sandwich generation. You've got your, you know, parents moving back in, your children. I think that there are developments out there that are thinking about universal design and adaptability ahead of us. So.
And Dimitri, I wanted to, because we only have 5 minutes left, I wanted to sort of focus your comment on sort of the future advances. You work with technology. How has this building, or how can buildings of the future harness technology more to address some of the concerns we've laid out tonight?
Well, I think there are lots of ways. I think that, you know, technology, that design, good design is really the answer to a lot of this. A lot of this is not really difficult technology. But I think that it's important to sort of think about what is disability? Disability is really an inability to function with the built environment. And if you build environments that are more usable by a broader range of people, what is considered disabled becomes much, much less.
So this concept of the universal design is design that sort of benefits all of us, really. It's not sort of just for one group or another. And on this sort of policy advocacy front, Susan, where are we going there? Where are you and your co-workers trying to push legislative boundaries that have helped you get so far, but maybe not as far as you'd like it to go?
Well, you know, the ADA is still being, you know, being pushed, and, you know, people are still adapting to the guidelines of the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are people out in the advocacy community who are pushing visibility requirements for private housing. So that's going on. There's, you know, and universal design is actually bigger than just design buildings. There's universal design in learning and education. So it's a concept that's sort of branching out. Mm-hmm. So all of those things, as we talk about education policy, we're talking about, you know, making sure there's universal learning experiences are embraced.
I see. And is there any legislation that's pending either locally or on the national level to kind of move us beyond what ADA is requiring?
I think there's been local legislation on visibility requirements mm-hmm. that has been passed in some areas. And so on a federal or state level, I don't know of any right now. Mm. I just want to add one thing to the whole thing about the future of our building. One of the things is we were finishing coming to completion, we decided to sort of, we kept telling ourselves, well, we know we're going to learn more, so let's just be happy. You know, let's not beat ourselves up about the things we didn't know.
I can't put Ed on Menlo Park on, but I'm going to ask his question. Can all buildings have an accessibility review?
Yes.
Yes? Yeah. Meaning, is it required?
Well, you know, there's new state legislation that could require a review. If somebody files a complaint against you in California, you have a chance to respond by having an accessibility review done by a certified access specialist.
But not unless a complaint is filed. So it's
right.
not...
You could do it voluntarily. Okay. Will people?
Okay. And Bill, I'm going to give you the last word. What's it going to take to scale up universal design?
You know, I think it really does take just broader awareness of these issues and the importance of thinking more broadly about design. I think there's a new emerging concept of what good design really means in architecture. I think for many years we've been focused really on the aesthetic, the visual component of it. But I think now we're starting to see a deeper understanding of what a deeper beauty might be. And that includes providing a greater connection to the natural world, but it also includes providing a greater connection to our broadest community, everyone in our community.
And it can be done within a reasonable cost?
Absolutely. This building was built within the same price range of a typical office building in California.
And does it have
in Berkeley.
Has it achieved a LEED certification as well?
It didn't because the client, I think, chose to take the money assigned to that, the actual certification process, and apply it to the actual building. But we think it's basically LEED Gold certified.
Very good. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dimitri Belser, Executive Director of the Center for Accessible Technology and President of the Ed Roberts Campus, Susan Henderson, Executive Director of the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund, and Bill Letty, a founding partner of Letty Matem Stacey Architects. Thanks all for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. We'll put links to all the organizations represented here tonight, including pictures of the campus. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. City Visions senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Freese manages our website. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday when our topic will be Minding the Gap, the successes and struggles of women in the computing industry. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.